You might have noticed me chuckling a little during the children's story that Paul shared when he was talking about the rebuilding of the temple. I just flashed on you all unwrapping these chairs and placing them in this space. So I just thought I should share why I seem to be laughing inappropriately. It probably won't be the last time that I have to issue such a disclaimer, but so we've all heard the story of Hanukkah. A beleaguered people, the Maccabees, far outnumbered by the Greek-Syrian army, somehow prevail in battle and they retake the temple. That is the first Hanukkah miracle. And the story might end there. The little guy wins. The Jewish Maccabees retake their temple and they rededicate it. But there are some complications. In the course of the battle, the Greek-Syrian army desecrates the temple. Now, every faith tradition has rituals, specific ways of doing things. In Judaism, one of the world's ancient religions, there are lots and lots of rituals. Rituals around the preparation of food, the slaughtering of animals, and rituals around creating sacred space. The invading army contaminated the Jewish sacred space by sacrificing unclean animals on their sacred altar. It was essential to the Maccabees that they rededicate and sanctify their holy space. I was reminded of this during an early presidential debate. You might remember candidate Kristen Gillibrand drawing laughter and applause when she said that if elected as president on her first day in office, she would Clorox the Oval Office, suggesting that the actions and policies of the current administration have contaminated our sacred ground, our great republic. This experiment in democracy, contaminated by corruption and by a me-first policy, leaving the most vulnerable among us out in the cold. In her throwaway comment, she was calling for a rededicating and a re-sanctifying of our republic's sacred space. Just as in ancient times, we find that today there are people on both sides of an issue that seems so clearly one-sided. We are meant to be a land of plenty, of welcome. We are called to care for one another, to share our abundance. How could there be more than one side to that? But just as today there are factions and unholy alliances, in those ancient days of battle between the mighty Greek-Syrian army and the lowly Maccabees, there was also in that time a civil war going on, factions within the community of the good guys. Can we relate to this? Maybe some sided with the powerful, overlooking their bad behavior, their unkind ways, so as to amass more power for themselves. Can we imagine such a deal being struck? Maybe there were some members of the Jewish Maccabees even who thought they could work with the Syrian king. His father, Antiochus III, had been tolerant of the Jews, letting them keep their religion while under his rule. Perhaps his son, Antiochus IV, could be reasoned with, cajoled, would be willing to make a deal. I don't know all the dynamics or who sided with whom, but what I am certain of, is that there was betrayal and disappointment. And we can relate to this, yes? Surprising alliances, people sacrificing larger values to the altar of greed, or maybe even just expediency. Maybe Antiochus IV was good for the economy. I suspect that this kind of deal-making and deal-breaking and heartbreaking was going on in some ways in that time in Judea over 2,000 years ago. warfare, and internal struggle, mistrust. There must have been despair, disgust, disbelief. Can we imagine this, my friends, going on in that time? So the story of the second miracle of Hanukkah, after the battle was won and the temple reclaimed, takes on even greater significance in that context. The Jews re-entered their beloved temple, and it was trashed. I don't even want to imagine, let alone describe, the horrible things that were done. Think of some of the hateful graffiti that has been scribbled on walls of sacred spaces today in this country, most especially on mosques and synagogues, sometimes even in holy burial grounds. The ruling Jewish priest, Judah, called on his followers to cleanse the temple, rebuild its altar, and light its menorah, the gold candelabrum whose seven branches represent knowledge and creation and were meant to be kept burning every night. But as the story goes, there was only one jar of purified oil available, only enough for one night, not seven, as would be required to complete the rededication and purification of the temple. But they did not wait for the Amazon truck to bring more oil. They lit the candle anyway, trusting that somehow there would be enough. And the miracle is, there was enough. The candles burned not just for one or two or even the required seven nights, but for eight nights. A miracle. Now, did this really happen? Did the oil somehow replicate itself, or did God temper the flames so that it conserved the precious oil? I don't know. No one knows for certain. No doubt some have studied the properties of combustion and the physics of the oil and the wick and the flame, or maybe they've pored over ancient texts looking for some error of transcription or translation that would explain and debunk this so-called miracle. I have no problem believing that miracles happen, that one jar of oil could last longer than seemed possible. But in my mind, that burning candle is not the real miracle. No, for me, the miracle is that they lit it anyway. Not knowing, and yet trusting that there would be enough, that light would prevail. And that story of faith in the face of evil, hope in the wake of despair, that was an important story. And remains an important story for the Jewish people to hear, so important that it has been told in much the same way for over 2,000 years. Like so many stories of liberation and deliverance from evil, it has no doubt been life-saving for people, especially for the Jewish people who have known suffering, slavery, bigotry, and hatred, all inflicted on them because of how they worship and how they live their lives. There are parallels, yes? This story of a tiny light lasting beyond expectation, beyond all logical explanation, could remind us all that there is hope in the struggle, that the light will return as it always does, but that something is required of us to experience that light. We must light the candle anyway, going on as if, some might say, but it feels much deeper than a game of make-believe. What is required of all of us, especially in this dark time, are many acts of faith, big and small. What good would it have done to have hoarded that one jar of oil, illuminating nothing and no one? Should we hold tight to what we see as ours, behind a wall, keeping others out for fear that they will take something away from us? No. What if instead we throw open the temple doors and let our light shine, trusting that what we need to keep our fires burning will always be replenished? Sharing what we have, trusting in abundance, choosing to have faith, choosing to have hope, letting ourselves know in our bones that the light will return, even when it is so dark that we can hardly remember the feeling of warm sun on our skin. That is the faith that was required of our ancient Jewish siblings, and it is what we need now. Now is not the time to hide our true selves, keeping our lamps low, avoiding surveillance, avoiding scrutiny. No, my friends, we must light our lamps and keep them lit so that those seeking light and warmth and commitment to values of justice and peace will find refuge with each other and with us. That would be a true miracle, lighting the candle anyway. I close with this blessing from Jan Richardson. Blessed are you in whom the light lives, in whom the brightness blazes, your heart a chapel, an altar where in the deepest night can be seen the fire that shines forth in you, in unaccountable faith, in stubborn hope, in love that illumines every broken thing it finds. May it be so.
Please rise in body or spirit.